Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing two interviews, one with David Breitbarth and one with Doug Jones. Both of these men are long-term members of the Oslo Repertory Theater Company in Sarasota, Florida. Both of them are multi-talented and currently appearing in Ah Wilderness. After the interviews, I am going to read a review of Ah Wilderness, written by reviewer Sharon Leslie. In these interviews, both Doug and David talk about not only how they became actors, but about the profession itself and what it means to them. These are stimulating, interesting interviews, so hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can.
Welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being the person you were born to be, which is to say, being the person you would have been if nothing had interrupted your development. In my shows, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, and I do that because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. David and Doug are exactly who they are. When you hear them speak, you can hear it. And so I'm simply going to let them speak for themselves now. Here is first my interview with David Breitbarth, and later my interview with Doug Jones. I'm here with David Breitbarth in the little conference room at the Oslo. And David has been part of the Oslo Repertory Company for
17 years.
I explained to David that I ask people how they found this work, not the very first job they ever got, but where did an interest in being on stage or being a character or any of that?
I had no aspirations at all in my childhood to perform in front of people. I was and still am to a degree shy, but I was a trombone player, as a kid. And I was pretty good for a while. A New Jersey All-State band, I think. And then I went to a boarding school, a sort of a progressive, hippy-dippy kind of small boarding school in the Berkshires in Massachusetts, where if you weren't required, you were urged to try everything. I was in the school orchestra as a trombonist. And
now, wait a minute. Were you thinking of making music a career?
No.
No, you do it just...
No, I secretly hated playing the trombone. I started playing the trombone because my best friend in fourth grade, Billy Hawthorne, played the trombone. He played the trombone, and I wanted to play the trombone, too. But playing the trombone is lonely business. I mean, you know, it's not like... It's like, ooh, I got to meet that trombone player.
Yes, it's nice.
You know,
no, right.
So in this high school I went to, where you were encouraged to try everything, you know, even if you were missing a leg, you were encouraged to try to play soccer.
Wow.
There's that kind of stuff.
Yeah, right. Reach for it.
I'm exaggerating. But, you know, it was part of, like, what the school believed about evolving and growing up and finding out who you were and what you like to do. And I got thrown onto a stage.
Well, so in your case, it actually worked.
In my case.
You discovered something that you didn't know about yourself. Because they put you there.
I discovered that I enjoyed, I had fun doing it. It brought me out of my shy shell a little bit. I got a lot of attention from girls. That was a big part of it. In fact, it was the only part of it in high school, at least. And I didn't know it at the time, but I really loved being part of a good story, you know, and figuring out what my role was in telling a story with other people.
So it's a joint thing. It's this is fun to do. This puts me in a fellowship, in a community, in a right?
Yeah. And the school was real big on community too. It's sort of a commie, you know, liberal school. So they were real big on community. And you know, theater is community. I mean, you can't do it with other people without other people.
No, that's right. So you know, this is really kind of interesting. I think unusual. I mean, I think a lot of people who become actors have an inclination that they want to do something like that very young, but really this came as a surprise to you.
Yeah, yeah, it did, totally.
Right.
It did.
So here you are in high school. Did you have any idea what you wanted to do?
No.
No, you were just coasting.
Well, I was in high school, yeah.
Well, oh my...
Yeah, I was coasting. Yeah, I didn't know what I wanted
to do. Right. You were, this is, you know, it's freshman, it's sophomore, it's junior, I'm here, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so, but as you approach senior, people start talking to you about what you want to do, don't they?
Somewhat. You mean in terms of where to apply to college?
If you're going to go to college?
Well, yeah, I went to a liberal arts school. My parents felt strongly, and the guidance people at the school felt strongly that everyone should get a liberal arts education.
Right.
That's
so again, by now, you still don't have a burning passion and a desire thing you're going to do it.
I questioned whether I wanted to be an actor through my 30s.
Ah.
And maybe into my 40s. I question it all the time. I sort of know I want to do it now, partly because I don't know what else I'd do at this point. But no, I've been questioning it all along.
Right. Okay, so when you question it, I'm assuming that the question has to do with, do I really still want to do this, or is this something that fulfills me and makes me happy? Not, there's something else I really want to do.
It has never been that for me, no. I've never woke up one morning and said, my God, I have got to try, you know, commercial law cases. That never happened to me.
Yeah.
But the doubts are usually, you know, because it's not an easy business to be in.
No.
And if you can't do it, then you're not enjoying it, because you're looking
for it.
For it.
Right.
And I've been very, very fortunate person to have had this job here at the Oslo, because I haven't had to look for work really.
No.
I've only had to worry about how to do it.
Yes. Well, I will say, and you are not going to say it, but I will say it. It doesn't have anything to do with luck.
Hmm. But it does. It really does. I mean, there are countless talented people in the world who just haven't had the right, they haven't, like, whether it's by choice or by chance, haven't gone down the right path.
Okay. So how did you luck into this?
To this job here?
Yeah.
Well,
were you working as an actor before, assuming the...
Yeah, I was working as an actor and living in New York City and auditioning. Mm-hmm. And I auditioned for Howard Millman, who was directing a play called The Immigrant, which is a play he directed often around the country. And a lot of theaters were doing it. A lot of people were hiring Howard to do it. And actually, the first time I auditioned for him for The Immigrant, I didn't get the job because I didn't know the Yiddish well enough. And so the second time I got an appointment to audition for the play, I called up an old wizened Jewish guy who I knew from another play and who grew up speaking Yiddish and had him teach me Yiddish over the phone.
Oh, my God.
Oy vey, oy God. And so I went into the audition and auditioned for Howard again, and he offered the job to me. And it went very well. And he offered it to me several times after that. And then finally when he was rehired to come back into the office.
Oh, he wasn't here then?
He wasn't here then. No, he was running the Jiva Theater in upstate New York.
Yes.
And directing freelance around the country as well. And so when he got the job here in 1995, I think, I told him that I would be interested in coming to Florida. I was living in Los Angeles at the time. And his second season, when he decided to do The Immigrant here, he called me and said, I'm doing The Immigrant, and by the way, you can be in Nicholas Nickleby and three other plays, too. And I said, okay. I'll come if you can guarantee me more than 1 year. And he said, I'll give you 3 years.
Right.
On a handshake. And I knew I could trust him.
So you assumed that it was a three-year gig?
I assumed that I would be here at least 3 years.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. And he said the same thing to Jimmy Clark, too, mm-hmm. at the same time. Because, you know, if you're in the business in L.A., you go out of town for 2.5 seconds
and they forget who you are. Right, right, right. Right.
And if you never had a name to begin with, and, you know, it's just you're starting over every time you go out.
So I suppose in some kind of cosmic way, the fact that you made this connection to Howard when you did was luck.
Well, it was as lucky as any actor meeting anyone else who rehires them in the future and changes their life, their career.
Exactly,
but Howard literally changed my life.
Yeah.
My career.
Well,
for the better.
Lots of, I don't know. I think that it's possible that a lot of actors would not have done what you did about learning Yiddish.
Oh, no. Yeah. No, a lot of actors would. I mean, the actors who booked The Immigrant before me,
yeah,
I mean, they didn't know any Yiddish.
Right. Okay. So then you got here, and you stayed here. So do you want to talk about what it's like to have been in a repertory company for 17 years?
Well... Sure. What do you want to know?
Well,
it's odd because it's more like a job than what most actors experience when they go to work somewhere.
Yes.
I mean, most actors, and certainly I lived this life before I came here, you book a job and you had it usually if you were working a regional theater job outside of New York or L.A. or wherever you booked it from, that it was 7 or 8 weeks out of your life where you would meet new people and do a play and then you'd be done and then you'd come back to New York or L.A.
and start again.
Auditioning again. And so the jobs themselves had this sort of, I don't know how to describe it, sort of like a vibrating glow about them. It was like, I got this job.
Right,
I'm going to go off and do this job. And it was like something really, really exciting. It sort of made you feel like a little kid. And I have this job, so I don't feel like, you know, every time a rehearsal starts,
I don't feel that anymore. Oh, yeah.
I get excited about doing parts and plays and working with directors and certain actors, but I...
God, this is such an interesting thing. This had never occurred to me. It's the good and the bad about being a freelance actor. I mean, on the one hand, you're always having to look, but on the other, when you get the job, it's like Christmas.
Yeah, it is if it's a good job. But it's not always
a good job.
Not always a
good job. No, that's right. That's right. Okay, so you have been awarded...
Bloemfontein Acting Fellowship from Ten Chimneys, which is a foundation in Wisconsin. Ten Chimneys is now a museum in a place called Genesee Depot, which is about 40 minutes outside of Milwaukee. And it's the estate that Alfred de Lanta Joan Fontaine built, and it's gorgeous. It's just a beautiful estate in the middle of the woods, and Laurence Olivier went there, and Helen Hayes, and Noel Coward. I mean, they would have these sort of summer-long parties, and each of them had their own little cottage.
Oh.
And it's like a little compound, and it's now a museum, as I said. And every year, for the past 7 years, I guess, they have had fellowship weeks where they have picked 10 actors from around the country to come to Ten Chimneys for a week and study with a master teacher. And one summer, the first summer I believe was Shakespeare, and one summer, the last year I think, was Joel Grey and American Musical Theater. And this year it's Alan Alda, who is going to do something about spontaneity on the stage. It's a pretty broad topic. We all strive to be spontaneous, or to appear spontaneous at least. So it's going to be interesting to see what he's going to, you know, putting us through.
Yes.
But it's going to be, it's just an awesome honor. I mean, it's like, it's an amazing thing. I just hope to hear a lot of great stories and meet some really fine, talented actors.
And have a hell of a time.
You know, apparently they wine you and dine you really well, and they put you up in a really nice boutique hotel, and they fly you out there, I think first class, I don't know. but it's just, you know, the thing about working here at the Oslo, as opposed to a place like Los Angeles, which I don't miss at all. I mean, I knew within a week of being in Los Angeles that I didn't have the kind of ambition that you need as an actor to make it there.
To work.
To work mm-hmm. consistently. Mm-hmm. I just was not interested in spending my life sort of networking, you know, in your sleep and going to a friend's house for dinner or stopping to get gas. Everyone seems to have a screenplay that's optioned everywhere. I found it so tedious. And so when I was offered this job, I pounced on it, not only because it was like work and consistent work, but that I didn't have to think about running my life in that way. And it was a relief because I absolved myself from garnering that kind of recognition, which to me is not useful, either as an artist or as a person. And so what's funny, and what I'm getting around to, is that what's funny about this getting this award is that I have this sort of, I guess it's, you know, within some circles, it's national recognition. You know, I mean, a lot of, you know, people who care about this sort of thing know that, you know, they have a list of names and they see mine's on it. I didn't try to get it, and I don't know how to deal with it. You know, I'm not equipped. I don't know how to deal with it.
I really understand this
one. Do you?
Oh, God, I understand this one so well. And it's an interesting, I want to say, dichotomy, because so many actors have the drive for the thing you don't have. It's almost ubiquitous. It's almost a part of what one thinks of as an actor, because they have to have it because of what you said. You don't have the drive to go and get it. You don't get it, you know? So you're a kind of anomaly, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think those of us who are happy working here and doing this kind of work, like I know Doug would agree with me, and I know Jimmy would agree with me, and is that we're interested in just doing it.
Yes.
And that's our reward.
And that's the gift that a repertory company can give to an actor.
Mm-hmm.
And there are not that many of them, repertory companies that...
They're like three.
Yeah, right. Do you know why that is?
Well, I think it's not cost-effective for many places. I mean, we're a resort community, so people like fly down for like a weekend or a week or two, and they can see four plays.
Ah, I see.
You'd be hard-pressed to find a theater in like the middle of, you know, like Kansas or something.
Right.
where people flock to for the weekend.
Right. Okay, so how did you get this?
What?
The award.
Oh, well, I guess this is the first year that the Oslo is one of the partner theaters of Ten Chimneys, and Michael was asked to submit a name or names. I don't know how many people he submitted.
Know.
No, I mean, but Michael called me at the end of the summer and said, "I'm going to put your name in for Ten Chimneys," and I was very flattered and happy about that, and didn't really give it much thought.
Of course not.
Because you know, right. Why should you? And then they called. I guess they do a review. I don't know how they review. I don't know anything. I mean, they looked at my resume and my picture, and maybe they Googled me or something. I don't know.
You don't have any idea how they chose you?
Well,
or what they saw, what they knew?
Part of the criteria is that it's a way to give back to actors who have been of service in the community and who have mentored people, like as we have. Of students here, of giving back to them and allowing them to have a mentor and a master teacher. Because those of us who work in regional theater, not that we're looking for it, but we don't get recognition.
No,
you
right.
know, we don't get Tony Awards.
Right.
We don't get Emmy Award. You know, we don't get awarded that stuff. What
right.
what we do is serve a you know a smaller community
yeah.
in the region.
Actually, you serve the art.
Yeah, well, that too.
Yeah, no, that is what you do.
Yeah.
And I don't know how it is in other repertory companies, but I know that here you are extraordinarily valued. I mean, you can see it in opening night when people are hungry to tell you how much they appreciate you.
Well, it's a nice feeling. I'm happy to take congratulations. It's just we all depend on each other for doing a good job here. You know, as rep actors believe that, you know, if we're not making somebody else look good, and if they're not doing that for me, then we're screwed.
Yeah.
I mean, because that's what we do here. We don't concentrate on us. We
no.
concentrate on the people around
You're
us.
You're not trying to be a star. You're trying
well,
to
yeah.
be an ensemble.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And there's a lot of things at play. You know, this is the quality of the play. There's the quality of the... I've done some of my best work in roles that aren't good. And no, you know, those are the nights that people don't come rushing up to me and say, oh, come to me. Because it wasn't like a featured part. But, you know, I know that I've done some of my best work in roles that sort of, where the characters sort of disappear, you know, a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the only reason. And, you know, I mean, everything's like the lighting designer and the costume designer. Everyone has,
oh my God.
Has, and the director, of course, has a piece of your performance.
Mm-hmm.
So... It's not all mine, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It's everyone's performance, in a way.
Forgive me, but congratulations.
Okay.
I mean, it's clear that you deserve it. You're a wonderful, wonderful actor.
Oh, thanks.
You're a terrific addition to this company. And I hope that everybody who hears this will find their way to Sarasota and get a chance to see David in whatever it is he's in, because it's truly, I mean, I've never seen you give a bad performance, and I have seen you do lots and lots of things.
Oh, there have been a few.
I believe you, but that would be your take on it, not mine. You want to tell us what you thought was a bit?
No.
And anyway, my guess is that your version of bad performance is... and not everybody else's. Do you know what I mean? Oh, never mind.
Oh, no.
I think actually you're blushing.
I am.
Yes, I think
yeah,
you are.
Are you sure it's not a tan?
It's very sweet. Okay, so the other question I'd like to ask is, having given really all these years to acting, is there anything that you would say about what it means to have given your life to acting?
I have no regrets, really.
No. So every time that you've thought, well, maybe I shouldn't be doing this, you have come back around to...
Well, you know, that was... It's as I said, it's hard to be an actor, and those thoughts usually were tempered by an economic stress.
Yes.
That's not to say I'm rolling in it now, either,
right.
But come to see that I'd much rather be doing something that makes me happy than thinking about, you know, am I going to be like living on the street when I'm 75?
And But anyway, one can act when one is 75. I mean, we have David.
Oh, yeah, David.
You know.
He's who I want to be when I grow up.
Everybody wants to be David.
Yeah.
We're talking about David Howard. At this point in the interview, David and I are talking about what it is like to be in a repertory company, which is to say, to be someone who is doing several different roles essentially simultaneously. And this is what David had to say about it.
It's like the Actors Olympics out there. It's crazy.
I stand completely in awe of the learning of the words. It's a feat even just to observe that you actually get the words. I mean, not to mention that you inhabit them with the character and that you manage to look like a different person. So you'd rather do something that you love than worry about...
It's the message of you can't take it with you.
Yes, it is.
I mean, that's a play about actors.
Yes, it is. About artists, really.
Yeah.
Right? About people who give their life to the art that they love,
mm-hmm.
and don't worry about the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It's a good place to stop. Thank you, David.
Hey, thank you.
So, as I told you, David is a person who has given himself to the art that he loves and is not worrying about the rest, which is to say that he is being the person he really is. He is not trying to be someone else. He's not trying to live someone else's idea of what a person should do or be. And for some reason I'm reminded, this of course could be true of every interview I do, but for some reason I'm reminded particularly of it now. The lines from Robert Frost's poem, The Road Not Taken. I shall be telling this with a sigh, somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. If your road, the road that's right for you, happens to be one that is less traveled by, not as often taken, still, you can take it if it's yours and feel about your life the way David does and the way you will hear that Doug does in a moment. And that will make all the difference. And now, David's fellow repertory company member, Doug Jones, who has a very unusual story about how he became an artist and how that made all the difference for him.
Usually, I begin my interviews by saying, now I'm here with whoever it is I'm interviewing, but for some reason, I didn't do that with Doug. We just started right in talking. So, here is my interview with Doug Jones.
I interview people who make their living or their life with their art.
That's me.
I know that's you. I always start by asking the same question, and that is, how did it happen?
My dad was working for the State Department, and we lived in Costa Rica. And I was speaking Spanish. We moved back to this country when his job ended. And I'm 3 and 4, and I'm trying to learn English. And one of the things my parents did was put me in a little drama class. And I took drama classes and made friends and learned English all at the same time. So I was really doomed, right from the beginning.
Because it was your introduction to the United States, it was your...
Right.
It came with all this lovely stuff, like friends and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And an interest in the theater. And, of course, it was an imaginative teacher, which was also a plus. And
you were very young.
I was young, yeah. I was, and I think I might have done my first play. You know, I might have been 4 or 5, and then I did plays always. I was in plays in school and community theater, which is something I could always do, although I considered other professions. And I thought about medicine, I thought about the law and so forth, but I was always in the theater.
Yeah.
And I was always doing a play, so...
And how were your parents about that?
They were fine with it.
It was their fault.
Yeah, right.
I had nothing to do with it. Went to high school and I did more plays, and I started getting some recognition. I was named Best Actor a couple of years in a row in Colorado, and I had some scholarships.
What did you major in?
English, finally. I was an English major. You know, it's kind of a great major for a drama person because, you know, you're involved with a lot of literature, and then you get to act it out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of spiritual, really. You're making the words flesh. You are acting out.
Right.
Well, stories, yes, well, that's what a play is. It's a story that's acted out. It's no more, no less, really. And that's one of the things I think as human beings we do best. We tell stories about what's happened to us, what's happened to our friends and family, mm-hmm. what our life has been like, what somebody else's life has been like. I mean, this all falls into storytelling.
Yes.
And into a kind of narrative of the human race.
And yeah. So you came out of college mm-hmm. as an English major.
Well, no. I left college in the middle of it because my college was so small. I mean, 300 men. It was tiny. it didn't have a drama department, and that's what I was doing all the time. And the acting that I admired, the British actors who seemed to be able to do everything.
Yeah.
They could do the classics and modern stuff. And I thought, well, I just need to do more of that. And I didn't know anybody. I just wrote away for the prospectus of the Guildhall School, and it sounded good to me. And I auditioned at Brooklyn Academy of Music, and I was accepted. And so I went over there, and I was the only American in my class, and I was a British drama student for 2.5 years. So,
oh, but that was terrific.
It's perfect preparation for what we do here.
Yeah.
For repertory, because right. we do everything.
Right.
And so they didn't worry about my being an American, because I could do that on my own, but I learned about Shaw and Shakespeare and European theater.
Stories.
Sort of the Western civilization of how to act in the English language.
So yeah. Now you've got this foundation.
Yeah.
Of the stories of the world, essentially,
yeah,
right?
Yes.
And the training that you can't get better training than you got, right?
No,
right.
That's right.
So here you are.
Yeah.
You emerge at what I'm guessing is to be
23,
out of
something like that.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. I wrote away to all the repertory theaters in this country. I think there were 30 of them then. And I got 2 responses. And then I got an audition, and I got a job at Baltimore Center Stage, which turned out to be a major rep. And I was there for a year, and in the season. And the next year I was at Cleveland Playhouse at Case Western, and I was there for quite some time. I was about there 4.5 years. And that really cemented my repertory experience, because it was a theater that had 3 theaters, a revival, classic revival house, a new play, Black Box, and a commercial house, a Broadway house. And so Richard Oberlin, who was the artistic director, could program a resident company of 15 people into all these 3 plays. And if you just spent a year in the commercial house, then well, you're ready for new plays. And he would switch you over to that, and he would move you around. A very terrific artistic director that we will not see his like again. So it was really more training, you know, in the repertory. And I was very grateful. I met a lot of people and repertory actors and directors that came through there. Richard Oberlin, just as a sideline, is the only artistic director that I know of that arrived at the Cleveland Playhouse, which was the oldest and largest repertory theater in the country, and as an apprentice, and did every job there before he became artistic director.
Even that way of thinking is gone.
Mm-hmm.
That philosophy of what is, how a person should be.
Yes.
You know.
That's right. Should know everything about your business.
Yeah.
I know. Maybe we'll get back to that, because there's so many virtues about doing that. I read Life in the Mississippi a couple summers ago. It was Mark Twain here talking about every twist and turn in the river. And I thought, this is boring. Why is he doing this? We're just being subjected to every little eddy and every little sandbar and every little... And then finally, you know, the light goes off in my head
mm-hmm.
that this is the metaphor, that if you're entrusted with something like your life or in the lives of somebody else, you better know everything about what you're doing. And what's moving about it is that he takes the time to do that. It's like sitting down with your grandchild and saying, this is where all the money is, and this is where the relationships are, and this is where you come from, and this is your family, and this is, it's somebody taking the time with you, and in this case, the reader, which is all of us, and leading us through, you know.
This is how you do it.
This is how you do it, and this is what it's about, and I know how to do it.
Right.
And I can take you through it. That kind of responsibility that I think we've also lost of artists taking care of their craft and taking care of the audience. And
do you think, I mean, I'm leaping, but do you think that that's because fame, success, whatever that is, has become so important that craft...
Mm. There is certainly some of that. It's kind of celebrity at all costs these days.
It's interesting, and for me, you know, really important. The theme of the show that I do is discovering who you really are and then becoming it. And I interview artists because it is my personal belief that if you're an artist in this culture, it's because it's who you really are, because we wouldn't do that unless...
And there's an artist in everybody, you know.
Yes, really, and that's the point.
Yeah.
To find that.
And it's one of the reasons that art speaks to us, too, because it's not that removed. I mean, oh, I could do that, I could see that, or I understand that, or that speaks to me. I can participate in that. It speaks to the artist in you in the way that maybe a religious man speaks to the spirituality in you when he makes this little bow to you. The spirit in me acknowledges
the spirit in you.
Yeah.
The artist in me acknowledges artist in you.
Yeah.
That's very lovely. And I've never heard anybody say that.
Okay, you heard it here.
All right. At this point in the interview, I mentioned to Doug that quite often in the same season, he is playing one or two or sometimes three characters who are very, very different. And sometimes he performs two of those shows in the same day. So he'll do a matinee of one show and an evening performance of a different show, and that the characters that he's playing bear no resemblance to each other. And so I asked him how he did that. So will you talk about how you do that shift?
Well, it's all about the how, and it's a place where you incorporate your observation and your reading and your imagination and your response to the script and move all the molecules toward that end, toward what that person is doing and looking. And it's a kind of a mystery and a detective story based on what the person does and what he doesn't do, what he says and what he doesn't say, what people say about him, who's lying, who isn't, your response to the kind of language that comes out of his mouth. It's all of those things together that you assimilate over time and in rehearsal and put together this character, hopefully, that is more or less different than anything else you've done.
Are you describing the Mark Twain approach to character development?
Well, yeah, I guess
I
am. Yeah, well, although, you know, in a rep situation, we really don't have,
you don't have
all
the time,
that, all that kind of time.
It does sound like you are looking at every aspect that you can.
That you can, to
find him.
Well, and to, you know, be true to the function of this person. You're this part of the story. And to have that occur. I'm the oldest of the acting company.
I think you mentor those who come at...
I mentor anybody who
will let you.
If they want it, fine. If they don't, fine.
Say, anybody who's ever seen you work knows how terrific you are, I mean, and how valuable you are in any company. So, wow.
Thank you. I just don't take anything for granted. I try not to.
That's another... less than popular point of view, I would think, these days.
Yeah, I don't think it's a good thing to take things for granted or to assume something that is not, that you don't know.
That you don't know.
For sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Things can change on a dime.
Yes, they can. They can.
Exactly. I remember coming down here to Sarasota in 1982 with my wife and my little boy, who was in three. He's 31 now.
Wow.
And it was the perfect place. But not because I researched it and I knew that it was the perfect place. I discovered that it was the perfect place. I was completely lucky. about coming to.
You know, I hear that story a lot from artists, that there's a serendipity, that there's a you know, that it was there's a Yiddish word for it. It's bashert.
Yes.
Do you know bashert?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. So that there's that factor in so many people that I interview, that it's as though this was, you know, meant, and you just fell in it, you know. And I mean, really, you fell into that drama school, didn't you?
Yes, in a way.
I mean, they could have done any number of things to help you learn English. They didn't need to do that.
A little drama class, yeah. That's right.
I mean, so even from the beginning, I mean, and really, you could have sort of got led.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
With kind of blind man's...
That's right. I know, no great... brilliance on my own. I followed the path that was open to me.
Well, I think that that's... forgive me, but I think that is a kind of brilliance. I think that a lot of people are afraid of that, unwilling to trust that, unaware.
It's kind of an Eastern thing to follow the path of least resistance, in a sense, the Buddha, in that teaching. And to like something that likes you back is another way of putting it.
Yes, yes, and to... to follow the road
that's lit.
That's exactly right. So I like to ask, is there anything that I didn't ask you that I should have? And or is there anything you want to say about what it is really like to make a life with an art?
Oh, my goodness. These are unanswerable. It's certainly been my life. I can't imagine life doing anything else, really, that I would be happy with. I will say that I'm just as happy and just as satisfied, which I think might be maybe a difficult thing to appreciate. A small part or a middle-sized part can be just as challenging and just as satisfying as a part that is tour de force. In a way, you're on stage and you have an ability to judge where it's going and the climate and the atmosphere of the response, and you have more time. If you're playing a smaller part or a middle-sized part, you don't have any time. You just have time to paint the color blue or paint green, not too much, and to move at the pace that the play is at. And that's hard to measure if you're not on stage, not to speed it up, not to slow it down, but to be...
Because somebody else is controlling the pace.
That's right, and there's and the audience, too. It's always you, the night, and the music, because an audience brings its own dynamic.
Oh, I love this.
Its own dynamic to a play, and some audiences are a little more cerebral and inner and reflective. And reflective, and some pick up on the humor more, and they want to have a good time.
Right. Oh my God! So you're constantly
shifting emphasis. I would say.
What is the word? Being fed by it.
There's a reciprocal response that always happens.
Yeah.
That is continuing to happen.
You know, it's interesting. And
that's the other thing I want to say.
Yeah.
Before I forget it, is that just my whole approach to acting is pretty much to approach an audience and other actors as equals. That we are.
In it together.
And this is different from another school of acting, which I would say is more to impress.
I have something to show you, to give you, and here it is.
There is some dynamic, and there's some dazzling pyrotechnics that actors can do that are astonishing and are very impressive. And I was just never as interested in that kind of acting.
Is that part of your training, as well as part of who you are?
Maybe it is. I mean, my training, I had a very terrific teacher, and you know, it's about being real, you know.
Yes.
And if it isn't real, it doesn't much matter.
Because the other thing is really manipulative, isn't it?
It kind of is.
Yeah. It's I act on you.
Dig me rather than get involved in the story.
Yes.
And I'm just part of this story.
And really what you were saying earlier, it seems to me, is what informs that, and that is the significance of the stories as it has to do with the way human beings interact and relate to one another, that's really what's important to you.
Yeah.
That's what you're doing.
It's how we treat each other.
Yes,
in the final
analysis. But not everybody has that point of view as an actor.
No. No, not everyone has anybody else's point of view, really.
I mean,
everyone has their own. point of view. I'm more comfortable with that one, I would say, than with others. I think there are other points of view that are completely as valid and look at the world just a little differently, and I just don't understand it as well. When I approach a scene, there are probably 12, 14 different ways to play it, and I'm only smart enough to think of maybe 3 or 4.
You're a really nice man.
Thanks.
So anything else about being an artist?
I'll tell you one thing that's happened to me is because I get older. I mean, I'm in my 60s, that I appreciate the other arts more and more. I just have become a huge fan of stuff that I never was as a young man, of dance. And I've always loved literature and writing and reading, but all the arts now. I love museums, sculpture and painting, more and more. I just think
you're expanding.
I am expanding my appreciation. As my own powers diminish, I think I'm appreciating more.
Don't do that.
Oh, well, it's sometimes very difficult to get out of bed in the morning, and that just wasn't true, you know, 25 years ago after you do a performance.
Well, I hear that, and I want to tell you that I watched you, and I thought, how the hell is he doing this?
Well, that's right.
No kidding.
Well, last year was also a good challenge. I did The Imaginary Invalid
I didn't see it.
And playing Iconda. And there was some singing and dancing, which I don't do, but I did it anyway.
If it's an actor's work.
Yes, well, I did it, but I don't do it, you know. Yeah, any singer or dancer would know, that's not singing and dancing. I said, I'm not very good at it. And Craig would say, well, just do the best you can, and it'll be just right.
Yes, I'm sure it was perfect for the character.
Well, probably.
I'm sure it was.
I'm sure it was.
This
was painful. It's supposed to be very good, Doug. You'll be perfect for it.
That's very cute. That's very cute. So here we have a man who discovered very early in his life something of a coincidence, an accident, a happenstance, that acting was what he was meant to do. And although it's not a complete through line from that moment at 3 or 4 to the moment when he decided seriously this was it, it was always there. It has always been there. And again, you hear in Doug the complete commitment to this work for its own sake, for doing this work the best that he can do it, to giving this art his best. It is not for him about money or about fame or about accolades or look at me. It is that his work is what matters to him, and he does it. Something of the road not taken and how it has made all the difference to Doug, and as I said a few minutes ago, to really all of the people that I interview. You can hear this being said over and over again in one way or another. Although they talked about various productions that they were in, both Doug and David are currently appearing in Ah Wilderness, which is running at the Oslo Repertory Theatre Company. It is always a joy and a delight to see either one of them on stage, but it is a double delight to see a play in which both of them are appearing, as they are in this production of Ah Wilderness. And now, before I close the show, I'm going to read a review of Ah Wilderness, written by my reviewer, Sharon Leslie. And here it is now. The Oslo Repertory Theatre Company is in the fourth year of its 5-year exploration of the American character. Currently, we get to watch how Eugene O'Neill portrays an American family vacationing in New London, Connecticut on the 4th of July in 1906. Mr. and Mrs. Miller and their 4 children and Mrs. Miller's brother and Mr. Miller's sister are vacationing at the shore. The children are at ages where the tug of war between dependence and independence is happening in varying degrees. Mildred and Richard are in their teens. Tommy is 12 and Arthur is 20. The thrust of the story is the coming of age experience by 17-year-old Richard. Sensitive, yet feeling his hormones, the bookish Richard has immersed himself in the edgy authors of his time. The socialist writings of George Bernard Shaw, the sexuality of the poems of Swinburne, the feminism of Ibsen, the mysticism of Omar Khayyam. Richard gets spurned by the girl he is madly in love with, goes off with the friend of his older brother to a place of ill repute, stays out too late, drinks too much, drives his parents crazy with worry, and eventually reconciles with his girlfriend through several twists and turns of the plot. What makes this play still relevant today is that no matter what the era, each of us must learn about the birds and bees and go through the trials and tribulations of love relationships. As a foil to the goings-on of Richard is the rather contented marriage of his parents, Essie and Nat, contrasted by the unresolvable love of Lily for Sam, the charming alcoholic brother of Essie, whom she refuses to marry until he changes his ways. Since the play is over 80 years old, the trick is how to create a production that stays true to the original atmosphere without feeling dated. This production, directed by Greg Lemming, hits all the right notes, as patriarch of the Miller family, David Breitbarth, gives one of his finest performances. The role of Nat Miller gives Breitbarth a range of emotions that showcase the breadth of his craft and display a warmth of humanity, from expressing anger, frustration, fatherly understanding, wry humor, manly interest in the female and his wife, to the age-old reticence of having that discussion with your son about the facts of life. He is the glue that holds the family together as well as the production. The central character is Richard, played by Tom Harney. His youthful passion is palpable. Denise Cormier mixed the fussiness of Mrs. Miller expertly with motherly concern. Peggy Roeder brings a wistful charm to the long-suffering Lily, who never gives up hope that Sam might change. As Sam, Douglas captures the exuberance of a man who lives to party with his friends, contrasted by the tail between his legs recriminations for his actions in the next day's hangover. Director Lemming adds songs of the era performed in beautiful harmony by the cast during the scene transitions that work as theatrical oleos, gently giving a sense of time and place. The set design by Stephen C. Kemp is edgy, yet era-evoking. The Victorian aspects of the architecture are hinted at by outlines of the walls and wood, details rather than full-blown backdrops. These suggestions of walls give the atmosphere a lightness that keeps it from bogging down and feeling too dated. What makes the set design edgy is the backdrop of green tiles abstractedly placed against a white background. The mosaic may function as a metaphor for the emotions being explored in the piece, or the mosaic of an American family. The era costumes by Tracy Dorman are charming and beautifully define each character. Ah, Wilderness is a comedy. The only comedy O'Neill wrote. And it's funny. Not farcical funny, but human relationship funny. The ins and outs of all the relationships are what make it work. And it's tolerant depiction of human emotion. You might actually laugh, smile, and be entertained by this classic piece of theater that, though set in 1906, speaks to us today. As I said, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. Both David and Doug are very much who they really are. They are spontaneous. They are honest. They are guileless. They are simply themselves. So if having listened to any of this has stimulated in you the thought that there may be something that you really are that you don't have access to, something that you left behind, something that you had to deny, something that you are not able to be, and you'd like to explore the possibility of recovering that, of accessing that, I would be glad to talk to you about that. And you can reach me at my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. Up there, there's a button you can click on that says email me, and you can ask me any questions. I will be happy to answer any questions that you have. And as always, I hope that you have gotten something from this show that you can use. Something that is going to bring you out to see our wilderness. Something that inspired you to ask yourself if you are being all of who you really are. Something that will bring you back, because I will be here next week, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. See that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So